Hello and welcome to What Most People Think, and it is finally budget week. We made it a bit like the build up to the Ashes, although probably, well, I would say a hope for a less disastrous outcome, but I'm not sure how it could be worse than England losing in 2 days. But we try and move on for that. We try and be positive. And in the sign that I don't just throw this show together, I've got this week comedian and financial oracle Dominic Frisbee. Dominic, are you psyched up for the budget?
I'm massively psyched. There's been a lot of hype, and this is the big week. I've never known hype.
Are you having the lads round? Are you doing a bit of a watch party? Get some stimulants in, some beer?
I should really. I've got Sky, especially to watch it. I've bought Sky.
Pay-per-view. I mean, it does feel like the way it's been previewed, there is a certain kind of political and financial nerd where I am sort of excited about it, but in the way that, well, it sort of feels like being excited for a root canal, in that I kind of want to be on the other side of the root canal. I know it's going to be terrible, but I just want to know how terrible.
I do think pay-per-view for political speeches could be one way of solving the budget deficit.
I think the people that would get people paying to watch them would be the Farages and the Zach Polanskis. I can't think of anyone from the two main parties that's absolute fucking box office.
Well, no, that's one of the problems that they have. But this one, because of this one is all about the information rather than the star. It's about the writer, not the actor.
Yeah, no, there's very few stars at the moment. So we're going to preview the budget, the leaks, the effect of the delays on the economy, Rachel Reeves accusing people of mansplaining to her, and also with the Ukraine deal seeming quite close, it seems to favour the Russian side, but there are counter negotiations going on. So we'll speak with a limited amount of knowledge of that, but it's a big deal, and you know, something could happen this week, so we're going to chat about that. And then in the Patreon only, we're going to have another death story. People seem to enjoy those. So me and Dom will trade stories about gigs that didn't go to plan. My one this week is about a gig that I did for a lawyer, and it went so badly he eventually withheld payment. Piss take prices, Dom. We've been doing a thing recently on the show where we're just getting people to nominate, you know, those prices that take your breath away, i.e. that when you've applied context, they still take your breath away. So the one this week, I'm just going to mention the price of any food at Turkish airports. It's been flagged by so many listeners and people on social media. It does seem like if you're getting McDonald's for a family of four there, we're talking like anything from 60 to 80 quid. Have you had any such moments in Turkish airports or otherwise?
Well, I was going to say generally airports are rip-off central. And for this reason, I actually bought shares in WH Smith because they have outlets in all the airports. And I bought it more as a means to sort of, so then every time I bought something in an airport, I'd think at least I'm a shareholder.
That was a smart move. Because that was the original piss take price that I did was, it was $3.99 for a 500 milliliter bottle of Sprite. That was where this all started.
Oh, really?
WH Smith's in an airport.
Yeah. I mean, so anytime anyone buys a Baro or a, you know, small bottle of water for 83 quid, at least I'm somehow benefiting from it. But I didn't realize that Turkish airports were like, you know, even by airport standards, were the ripoff of the ripoff. I didn't know that. So I've come away with something, Jeff.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. If people want to get in touch, it'd be good. David Domain, our super patron, which we'll come to in a second. But if there are any specific reasons why Turkish airports are so bad.
I bet you it's to do with the fact that, because I once went to Cuba in 1994, and it was like the Cuban currency was a total disaster. And so they could only use dollars for anything that was not made in Cuba. And the Cuban airport was one of the most expensive airports I'd ever been to, and it was all priced in dollars. And I wonder if, because the Turkish lira is so crap and they have such bad inflation, so they price everything in euros and dollars in the airport. I wonder if that's got something to do with it.
Yes, and maybe they just know that English people at the airport will be hungover after 7 days of solid drinking, so just need stuff with fat and salt in.
I don't think the prices are specific for the English. I think their prices across the board.
Yeah, or do we know? Maybe there's just a button that they press underneath. underneath like an alert button, go, all right, we've got a family of English people. And then suddenly like the menu all like drops down. They go, they can't get enough of this shit. And they're also, another shocking one was £5.80 for a sausage roll at the away end at St James's Park at the football. I mean, I'd apply a little bit of context, but £5.80 does seem high. So if you want to let me know a piss take price that you've seen, email whatmostpeoplethinkuk@gmail.com or stick it on a hashtag on social media, which I check occasionally.
Can I say my beef with rip-off prices, my specific one, is non-alcoholic beer.
Yes.
Because they charge the same price as they charge for normal beer, but because it's non-alcoholic, and the fact you have to prove you're 18 to drink a non-alcoholic beer, which is insane.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Oh, I've got a routine then I might have to revise, because that's mad. Why? Unless they're acknowledging that there's something particularly toxic in it.
I don't know, but when I buy non-alcoholic beer at my local co-op, I have to pay to prove that I'm 18. I don't know why that is. Maybe not in a bar. But why do they charge the same price for non-alcoholic beer when there's no beer duty on non-alcoholic beer, presumably?
Well, it's a virtue tax, isn't it? They do that with certain other healthy foods. Like the moment something becomes a superfood, you can guarantee they're going to double the fucking price.
Yeah. Do you know how they charge like £3 for a pint of Coke in a pub, and they just squirt a little bit of, and they make more on the pints of Coke than they do on the actual beer because of all the beer duties? I'm sure something similar is going on with that, like with that, but at a whole different level of ripoff.
Yeah, you know that the sensible people pivoted a while ago, in the same way the tobacco giants just suddenly went, right, vape, anything that we can stick nicotine in, powder, syringes, you could probably just inject nicotine now. It would be, you could literally get a small syringe where you can mainline nicotine, but as long as you don't have a cigarette, then, you know, the Ed Miliband's of this world are going to be happy. New patrons. Remember, if you're a patron, you get the podcast early, ad-free, and with bonus content. It's better for all creators if you do it via the website or Android. But if Apple is the only one you can do, by all means, do that. I had a patron, a VIP patron, that I apparently didn't give a shout out to. And she came and said hello at the gig in Maidstone. So Claire Morrison. As you know, Dom, we've roast names.
Yeah.
Claire Morrison. I mean, it's a tricky, it does sound very much kind of like sort of clerical business space, you know, Wernham Hogg type name.
Yeah.
You know, like an occasional character in the UK version of The Office.
It is a very normie name.
Normie names.
So if she was a Misterman character, she'd be Mrs. Normal.
Mrs. Normal. There you go. And she'd be Mrs. Normal, and you would have to report something to her once a year. You would only have one dealing per year with Claire Morrison from finance is sort of the obvious one, but she might compliance. Claire from Compliance. She seems nice.
Veteran of the compliance game.
Daniel Pinheiro, I think is a returning. It's always nice to see people coming back. That just makes me think of a football song. Pinheiro, whoa, Pinheiro. He comes from
Italy.
And pisses in the sea. We've also got Michael Flynn, who again, I think another returning page, or maybe people are just re-signing through the website to kind of make sure that I, as a content creator, gets more money, which is very much appreciated. Michael Flynn is just your classic. He's an Irish poet, but was never quite up with the Keats and the Joyces of this world. Michael Flynn.
And to return to gardening.
He had to return to God. He died unacknowledged, Michael Flynn. And even when he was acknowledged, it was a very niche market for Michael Flynn's.
Can I just say, what did you say Pinheiro was? Football player?
I just thought it reminded me of a football chant. It had a natural kind of...
As soon as you said Pinheiro, I was thinking of the old... there was an old English playwright, Arthur Wing Pinheiro. I was just thinking to myself how much more cultured I am than you, Jeff, that I was thinking of veteran playwrights.
I think being more cultured than me isn't the win you think it is. I mean, it's like being better value than a Turkish McDonald's. We got Stephen Vest as well. Now, that's a new name. Vesty. Now, that is so prime for blokes to give him nicknames. A String. His mates are calling him...
I was going to say Stringy.
Yeah, String Vest. Vest... I suddenly said that there was loads of nicknames to get out of this. I vest my case.
Well,
I think I'm going to have to, as I didn't have any other ideas. Domain talking point. David Domain, as you know, who keeps an eye on previous issues that we've discussed, and we talk about the funding of nuclear power. And he says the funding of nuclear power seems to be a main issue over the years, hence political inertia and the underfunding of nuclear civic engineering. An infamous example was when the then Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg rejected the idea of new nuclear power stations in 2010 because they will only provide a benefit in 2021-22, which I think was when we had the issue with Russia invading and never having needed our own energy supply more. Just around when we were starting to close down coal-fired power stations as well. And how ironic was it the UK pioneered nuclear power in the 50s? I mean, I just put that on a list of stuff that we started and are no longer that good at, from cricket to fucking nuclear power.
It shows you also just how short-term political thinking is. I mean, it makes you despair that they can't even think within a 10, 15-year time frame. I'm quite bitter about nuclear power, Jeff, because I participated in a debate the other day where you had to say what was the greatest invention, technological invention of the 21st century. And I said the smartphone. Somebody else said graphene, and somebody else said AI, and somebody else said social networking, and I beat everyone hands down. And I got to a showdown, and the winner was a guy who argued small modular reactors, nuclear reactors. And I was like, they weren't even invented in the last 25 years. They were invented way longer ago than that. And secondly, nobody uses them. Like, everyone's got a smartphone in the world, and you're winning it on something, the fact that nobody uses them because they can't get built. And he won. I'm still quite bitter about it.
I mean, I'm just trying to imagine the world where this is like a World Cup of, what was it, a World Cup of ideas? What's going on here?
It was the Battle of Ideas, so yeah.
Oh, it's the Battle of Ideas. So this is exciting. So there's like, is there a round robin phase, or is it straight knockout?
Everyone pitched their idea. There were about seven or eight, and the top three went through to the playoffs. And the top three were graphene, small modular reactors, and the smartphone. I got second by one vote, and I should have demanded a recount, but I didn't.
Do you have any fans, like crowd trouble breaking out on points of order? What happens if it's at level? Do you go to penalties where you have to like pick much smaller ideas? And
yeah, there was somebody, it was quite a green audience, and they were saying, we have to take in the environmental account and nuclear reactor and blah, blah, blah. And so the green lobby went against me.
Fucking green lobby, mate. Treacherous pricks. The reasons why illnesses, we were talking about illnesses. The reason why illnesses are more prevalent in cold weather is because the dew point in cold weather is below the ideal range for humans. Once dew point drops below around 5 degrees, the air, it will increasingly dry the mucous membranes out, which makes you more susceptible to germs. I mean, I do think, I don't know, maybe I'm particularly naive on this, but how I've got to the age of 48 and not knowing that.
How do you spell dew point? D-E-W or D-U-E?
Yeah, I wasn't saying the dew point. That would have been, that'd be a slightly different argument. I mean, that would be like a next level racism blaming.
I was going to say, not on this show.
Well, people have blamed the Jews for a lot of stuff. I think even for your absolute complete anti-Semites, you know, illness would be.
Yeah, the common winter cold is a stretch.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't rule anything out based on social media. I remember when I was a kid, it was like, right, if you're cold, don't go out with wet hair. Because you get ill, which is obviously fatuous. That's not true. But then people's like, oh,
no, it is true.
What, wet hair?
Yeah, you get cold with wet hair because you get a cold head.
What? How does that affect airborne viruses?
I don't know, but you will catch a cold if you go out with wet hair in the cold, 100%.
Are you saying that you don't want to let go of this conviction rather than that there's an actual scientific basis for it?
I can't tell you what the scientific basis is, but I know it's true because I've done it and it's happened to me.
Well, there you go. Look, the frisbee theory of airborne virus. See, where were you when they were doing the fucking COVID stuff, mate?
I'll tell you what I was doing. I was going around in the dark of night projecting subversive messages onto buildings.
Ah, yes. I remember now. Yeah. Well, listen, so it turns out we go back to now saying that when it's cold, you are more likely to get ill. So when your nan says, wrap up warm, fucking listen to her.
What most people think.
Okay, the thank you and the fuck you for this week. The thank you were to people that came to Maidstone and Leicester gigs last week. The Maidstone gig, Hazlitt Theatre, full on a Wednesday. The energy was unreal. Leicester, really good crowd there as well, although it was one of the first really cold days. And it's really weird doing a gig in a theatre when most people are wearing their jackets. But they were a nice crowd. I'm looking ahead to the last two dates this week of the autumn leg of the tour. That's the Hawth Theatre in Crawley on Friday, and then Leicester Square Theatre, which I think that there's just literally about 11 tickets left for that on Saturday. And then it's on to 2026, man. Get yourself on Live Nation. And I would say that if you came to the work in progress leg of this tour, the show is different now. It's significantly different. I'm going to rewrite the politics section over the winter because there'll be 2 months. And I'm going to bring it all up to date. So if you saw it in the spring of this year, then do come along to the spring of next year. Dom, the fuck you. What you got?
Bazball.
Baseball. What the fuck you is to the England cricket team?
No, I mean, we're just so good and we're so talented, but the amount of times we've snatched defeat from the jaws of victory, and I get what you have to do, but to collapse in the way we did from the position we were in, you know, come on.
It was unacceptable. So this is the first Ashes test that was heavily trailed. England team, highly rated, but mercurial. Went out on day one, bowled out cheaply, but then bowled the Australians out cheaply, which doesn't happen that often. And then I got totally carried away after day one. I was like, the Aussies are going to tear each other apart. And then I woke up, I set my alarm to get up at like 6 a.m. and we just lost a clatter of wickets and we were 88 for six. Do you know what I think happened? There'll be a lot of talk about prep and a lot of talk with this team about kind of like whether or not they bat in between. I just think we choked. I think we had them and we were 100 ahead with 9 wickets left and we haven't won a test in Australia since 2010 and they just choked their little fannies off. That is underpriced in the analysis of what went wrong there is they glimpsed what they really wanted and they just fell apart.
But we should have just turned ourselves into Chris Taveray and Jeff Boycott and that guy who used to bat number three in the under Michael Vaughan, who just grounded out. He was
Jonathan Trott.
Thank you. We just should have grounded out over like 3 days and made them sweat and got a 400 run lead batting at one run and over and just like
one and over. That'd be,
yeah. And just like suck the life out of them.
It was so
like one of my gigs.
It was so dispiriting. I mean, it was just humiliating on every level. And then Travis Head comes out, and when I saw him coming out to open, I was worried because I thought he could just win it in a session or two. Turns out half a session.
The other guy got injured, hadn't he?
Yeah, yeah. And he comes out, and I did a tweet which sort of went viral on cricket Twitter, which was that saying, you know, the worst thing about Travis Head is he doesn't even have the common decency to be dislikable. There's a couple of the lads in this Aussie team, I'd probably say Cummins and Stark as well, where you go, look, you're supposed to be cocky pricks. That's how this game works. You win at cricket more often, but the consolation for us is that we're better people, we're gentlemen, yeah, and you're cocky beach pricks. And it turns out they're actually nice blokes as well. So, yeah, great shout. Fuck you to Baseball, but also fuck you to the Aussie cricketers for not being pricks. Let's get into it now. We're going to talk about everything in and around the budget. We're going to make a few predictions, so let's crack on. So the budget is happening this week on Wednesday. We're recording this Monday morning. Before we get into like the real technical stuff, Dom, Rachel Rees, this article in The Times where she was complaining about mansplaining. I mean, I did think timing-wise, this is a really interesting point at which to bring in identity politics, particularly when you've made a lot about the first chancellor since the England ever existed in the 800 years and... And the fact that there have been piss takes of chancellors in the past. We've had Spreadsheet Phil, we had Boy George Osborne. And I also thought the nickname Rachel from Accounts wouldn't exist if she hadn't slightly lied on her CV. So is she, just like the England cricket team putting excessive pressure on themselves, has she done that a bit here?
I think she has. And you know, when somebody in that kind of position falls back defends herself using identity politics rather than the actual issue at stake, it just shows that, you know, they're inherently dishonest, basically, and they haven't got a leg to stand on. And, you know, when somebody falls back on identity politics, that just, to me, just says bullshit artist. You haven't got the metal and you haven't got the depth. And, you know, she's lied before. It's been proven. She exaggerated on her CV. She said she was a chess champion and it turned out she came 26th. And all the stuff about 10 years at the Bank of England and however many years on the Japan desk.
Some plagiarism, I think, in her book as well.
So, you know, she's undermined herself and she's turned herself into a laughingstock. And I have to say, I'm really surprised she's kept her job. But it is, to Keir Starmer's credit, he seems to be pretty loyal. He's got many flaws, but he does seem to be loyal, Keir Starmer, and that's to his credit. But the Labour Party do this thing that the Tories used to do as well, is they constantly leak stuff beforehand as though it's going to be a policy, and all they're really doing is just testing the water. Yeah. But they've been doing this so much that literally nobody quite knows what's coming. But the other thing is, you're like, well, what do these people actually stand for? What's your first principle? What's your philosophy? I really hold her in pretty high contempt, I must say.
they've sort of done the budget at more or less the latest possible point they could have done in the year. You talk about the leaks there. You know, a lot of people do think that that's had a cooling effect on the economy. I speak to people that are sort of saying, I'm going to wait to see what happens in the budget. How badly are we going to get clobbered, right? There's a state of inertia in the economy that exists because of them. I did wonder, when you talk about the leaks, I think it's important. Should we introduce fines for any story which ends up in the press? But not like, you know, like they do in football clubs, yeah. Like if you swear or you get a yellow card or a red card, but just like salary fines. And so levy them at the people, the absolute power holders, because then they're the only ones that can really cascade that kind of information down.
I'm all for it, because leaks are in themselves dishonest. And because they're leaks, and so there's a breach of trust. But they're just a political tool. You know, everyone gets their knickers in a twist, and then a week later there's another leak and it's something else. And, you know, they're deliberate. So yes is the answer.
Forfeits as well. Maybe forfeits, like Keir Starmer has to shave one eyebrow. I mean, that'd be quite funny, wouldn't it? Like a politician having to get up to the dispatch box with just one eyebrow shaved off.
What most people think.
Look at the year and a half that they've had, right? Having trounced the economy when they got in, delayed their first budget, said that this is going to be the only bad one. They sort of then bottled the spending cuts that they'd pledged in that budget on sort of wealthy pension and benefits and on welfare itself. Then they trailed an income tax rise, and then they bottled that. Are we going to end up with this much touted smorgasbord of bullshit, which is just like literally trimming around the edges on 100%. So many small taxes? Well, given that, then would you have been more comfortable with just a straight rise in income tax then?
No.
So what should they do then?
There will be an effective straight rise in income tax because they're freezing the thresholds, so they're taxing you via inflation.
Yeah, because they pledged to unfreeze them by a certain year, and it will now be that maybe that freeze continues.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm a small tax, I'm a low tax, high individual responsibility, small government guy. So I'm going to say what they should do from that philosophy. But from the position that they're in, like in the trust budget, which is, you know, they only tried to shave off 2.5% of spending, 2.5%. And look at the furore that it created. And you know, when that budget came out, I was like, yes, 100%. And I didn't realise that the Bank of England were going to shaft them in the way that they did. And we now know that they did, because the Bank of England announced 64 billion, whatever it was, of bond sales the day before the budget came through. And that's what tanked the bond market. Not, you know, it was the beginning of quantitative tightening. It was not the trust budget. But of course, history is rewritten by the left controls the media, and that it was written by that sort of, the media failed to explain it properly.
The left, which media?
The Telegraph weren't quite as bad, but you know, the BBC and the Guardian and they all blamed the crash in the bond market on the budget. The crash in the bond, if you actually look at gilt prices, they had started to go up the day before the budget, and it was because the Bank of England did quantitative tightening. So it was instead of buying bonds, they were selling bonds for the first time, gilts, I should say. So we need lower taxes, and we need simpler taxes, and we need fewer taxes. It's quite simple. And, you know, I wrote my book about taxation, Daylight Robbery, but one of the key things I said is that you design a society by the way you tax it. And you also determine the destiny of that society, whether its people are going to be prosperous and free or whether they're going to be subjugated and poor. And at every step of the way, since Nigel Lawson, successive chancellors, Labour and Tory, have just added layer of complexity. They've added more and more taxes. But with each tax, there's all these get out clauses so that some people get let off, and which adds more and more complexity. And Rachel Reeves is going to do exactly the same thing with this budget. And then they can't understand why there's no growth. Well, the reason is this, you know, taxation is like, if you can measure the freedom of a society by how much it's taxed, and the more it's taxed, the less free they are. You can't have freedom without economic freedom. They don't understand why there's no growth. It's because taxes are too high and regulation is too small.
But if they were, right, so they've got no, they're not going to take on spending, clearly. They're too scared to face down their backbenches. But if they weren't to raise tax, you know, if they were to even cut taxes, there would be a reaction in the bond markets. Now, that might be temporary.
They are terrified of losing control of the bond market. And they've reasonably managed themselves in such a way that, you know, for all her failings, the bond market, I mean, the yields on gilts are still more expensive than they are in the rest of the Eurozone, but they haven't got out of control. So she's kept things, you know, she's kept the bond market reasonably sweet. That's one of the few things she has done. But I think it's keeping the bond market sweet, which has determined everything else she does. Now, the problem with that is when you're in too much debt, which is what we are, and when you're too reliant on debt, you become too dependent on the bond market. And that determines all your policy. And so that's the mess that we're in. But, you know, that's the one thing that she's kind of kept a lid on.
But if you're a low tax guy, and I am too, is there a point there? You know, like when the left say, I'll just borrow more to spend more. There's two ways of spooking the bond markets, right? One of them is to cut taxes. One of them is to just raise spending and increase borrowing. Is there a point where you just have to accept that there might be a period where the cost of borrowing goes up, but that you have growth which offsets that and then calms the bonds market? Is somebody at some point going to have to accept a 6 to 9 month period of fear and anxiety before they see the effects in the real economy and growth and things start to settle down?
Yeah, well, what you described, Jeff, is what Paul Volcker did in America in 1980. And it kind of happened here, but not quite to the same extent, where I think interest rates in the States went to 17 or 18%, something like that. Ooh. At one point. And so, you know, anyone with debt that wasn't fixed would have been absolutely annihilated, you know, mortgages and so on.
I mean, you understand their problem to a point. Like, you know, what will happen then? I mean, Liz Truss, the main reason people are pissed off with Liz Truss isn't necessarily about, but it was quite simply that their mortgages went up quickly. Now, there is an argument that they would have got to that point.
Well, they would have.
At some point, but they went up, they got there quicker than they might have otherwise done is the least of it. So you sort of understand the bind that they're in.
I completely do. And, you know, I think one of the reasons in the 90s and the noughties, nobody trusted the Tories and nobody forgave the Tories. It was the crash in the housing market between 1989 and 1994. And when people lost their houses and they were putting their keys through the letterbox and repossessions.
Did that actually happen, by the way? I always thought, was that one of those euphemisms from when I was a kid where I misunderstood it? But that, I remember being young and people saying, oh, so-and-so's had to put the keys through the letterbox.
Yeah, yeah. It was common. I remember it.
Yeah, but is that a euphemism? Because like when you give the house back, it's not the keys, is it? You got to do the paperwork. When I was a kid, I was just thought,
people literally, they just walked away and they just left the house there.
What like those kind of flash cars that were left in Dubai once when they had their crash?
They literally just walked away and left the house.
Okay, I mean this is where we need your knowledge because I'm here saying thick things like, oh, was it just the keys then? Like,
no. I know. I mean, what do you do with the keys?
Well, who'd you give them back to? Is it the bank or the estate agent?
I don't know. That's why they put them through the letterbox. And certainly,
whose letterbox?
The letterbox of their own house. They would just move their shit out and they would just leave the house and walk away from the debt.
Oh, I see. It was their own letterbox. That makes more sense.
Oh, I see. You didn't realise which letterbox.
Whose letterbox? That's just the big question.
Go down the local Halifax in the high street and put your keys through the letter. No, that wasn't happening.
One thing I do think is while there's some sympathy, just quickly, like about the position they're in, is it didn't necessarily have to be like that. Where they're at is a consequence of not being able, you know, setting a sort of excessively negative tone about the economy, suggesting reasonable spending cuts, bottling an income tax cut. So the position they're in, the decisions they make probably are the ones that they have to make in this point. It's just the culpable thing is how we got here.
Well, exactly. I mean, Volcker did that and the tough medicine he imposed, you know, basically it purged the system and it enabled the huge boom that happened in America in the 80s and 90s. And similarly, it's like a, what do they call it? Creative destruction is the Schumpeter term for it. But I don't think people, you know, people have long memories and they never forgave the Tories for that crash in the housing market. And then we had Black Wednesday and all of that when Soros shorted the pound. And that kind of crisis becomes historical. And so, yeah, I think successive chancellors have been terrified of that. And, you know, the remedy for the housing market and unaffordable housing is lower prices. But nobody wants lower prices in the housing market because then the value of their house goes down. So they say, oh, we've got to build more. But that doesn't give you lower prices. That's what, if people are, young people are going to be able to afford a house, we need lower prices.
Maybe we just need to continue with the managed decline, but make sure that the decline is very well managed. You know, that is just nice, easy. You know, like when someone's on their last legs and we're just going to make them comfortable. That's what we're going to do at the end.
It's like when you're doing a gig and you're like, you're 12 minutes in and it's kind of going okay, but it's not going very well. And it's just sort of fizzling out. And you go, do you just get really round and confront everyone and really turn it round? Or do you just get to the end of your 20 minutes and then just leave it to the compere to sort out?
I think Starmer and Reeves are very much going to be like, look, let's just do our time, get in the car, get the fuck back on the M1. We're going to talk about Ukraine now, because at the back end of last week, a deal emerged, which was led by Russia and the US. There have been a few false starts, right? There was the big meeting in Alaska, which was kind of like Rocky IV, wasn't it? And that sort of, it seemed to, not much seemed to happen there. Donald Trump didn't run up a mountain and shout out Drago or anything like that. So it was on to the next one. And then we get this initial plan which emerged, which kind of sounded, I mean, Russian-centric is probably a polite way of putting it. Russia kind of gets quite a lot of regions. No chance of Ukraine joining NATO. They have to have a smaller army. Ukraine has to be called Diet Ukraine or something. And you know, everyone has, every fifth child has to be called Vladimir. So it's kind of an
Ukraine.
And then, you know, there was a natural reaction. There were some comparisons with the deal that the Trump administration had got with Neville Chamberlain. I mean, before we get into the sort of guts of it, Neville Chamberlain, it's always like a terrible thing if your whole legacy is characterized by just like one act of failure. He did a Neville Chamberlain. I don't know if you ever saw the film Kingpin, but do you remember there was a character in it called Roy Munson? And he basically bottled it in a big bowling final. He goes back there years later and then someone says, oh, that guy did a Munson. And he's like, sorry, what's that? He's like, Roy, you know, a Munson, like fucked it up, complete loser, that kind of thing.
Chamberlain, and I've discovered this writing the Gold Book, got the nickname in on the continent for pandering to the Nazis. He got the nickname J'aime Berlin, as in I love Berlin. J'aime Berlin.
He was J'aime Berlin.
Yeah. But what you don't know about Chamberlain is, I think I'm going to get this wrong, but it's sort of slightly right, is that he had six or seven brothers and he lost them all in the First World War.
Yeah, there's definitely context around.
Did not want to go to war because of what had happened to his, because of his own personal experience. And when you frame it like that, you go, oh, well, fair enough.
Yeah, and there was a lot. I mean, it was understandable that after, like, the blood, I mean, there was greater lives lost in terms of troops in the First World War. Like, it was traumatic on a scale that the planet had never ever seen before. So the reticence is, but that's the point. It's like you said about Liz Truss with how her budget went. Like, history has to remember it in a fairly singular way.
The other one like that is Enoch Powell. You know, he was a very good politician and very well respected intellectual, and all he's remembered for is the Rivers of Blood speech. And if you actually watch the Rivers of Blood speech, it's kind of pretty anodyne, and it's not a very good speech, and he's not like fucking Hitler. He's just like reading it off his notes.
Well, yeah, I was listening to the rest of his history, and either side of that he was doing some really kind of liberal lefty stuff as well. So
all he's known for is this fucking being this crazy xenophobe, and it's just like, that wasn't him.
Well, I mean, it does suggest that, mate, just like with Starmer with his Island of Stranger singers and Rachel Reeves talk about mansplaining. I'm not conflating all these things, but it's definitely worth picking your words.
Yeah, Island of Strangers is worse than Rivers of Blood.
They both sound like Willie Nelson songs. Most people think. It's sickening, you know, in a way that, you know, Putin sort of wins, really. But then there's a counter argument to this. If you look at the resources he's expended, like the sort of financial effect on Russia, you know, the amount of lives that have been lost, I don't see you could see this as a win as such. But it definitely feels, I don't know, it's Russia, it's kind of strange. Like, if you look at the size of their economy and stuff, they are sort of overachieving.
Yeah.
In a way, you know, if you look at what their global importance should be, is that the core of this conflict? In the same way that people accusing, you know, Britain of still thinking as the empire, they still want to matter on the world stage in a way that punches above their actual importance.
Well, I mean, you've got to remember Russia's landmass, and Russia's economy sinks or swims on commodities prices. You know, the price of agricultural goods, the price of metals, the price of oil and gas. And these things all tend to go through cycles where they become very expensive and then they collapse in price because they got expensive, everyone starts producing more and then the price comes down. But if you look at, like, there was a huge collapse in commodity, like the 70s, commodities prices boomed and boomed and boomed. And then there was a collapse in commodities prices through the 1980s. Oil, for example, got very, very cheap. And that, you never hear about it, but that was what led to the collapse of the Soviet Union, because they just weren't earning any money anymore. And then you sort of got the rise of the Soviet Union again in the noughties because commodities prices were on a boom. And then they've sort of collapsed over the course of the last decade. And so Russia struggled a bit. But what's interesting is like if you go back before the 20th century, war was a really effective business model because you like if you're the Roman conquerors or something, you go somewhere, you conquer it, you plunder it, and then you tax it. You take in a load of slaves and have them working for you as well. And so that's why kings and emperors and so on like to wage war. But then what changed about war in the 20th century is that they lost the plunder for the, like, so when British won World War II, we didn't get mass plunder and taxes and all the rest of it. So we had the cost of the war without the sort of reward of the conquest. America did get some of the conquests because it lent money and everyone had to pay them back. So this war that's been taking place in Russia and Ukraine, like if Putin gets a little bit of land, well, he'll increase his tax base, but he's not going to get plunder and taxing and all the sort of things that you got with previous wars. So I agree, both sides have kind of lost really, even though Putin's won.
When you were talking there, it reminded me of the buy-to-let market, you know, where the actual incentives to do it just got out of the game. Once upon a time, you do all right, you know, but these days,
it's just not worth the aggro.
You're lucky if you skim a little bit off the top. I mean, when you look at lives lost, you principally go the human cost of this makes it like a bad decision. I mean, there's a lot of criticism of Europe, but there was a point when, you know, they invaded where the idea was that they were going to go all the way to Kyiv and you know, maybe a sort of wholesale takeover of Ukraine. So the Europe sort of did cobble together slightly better than one might have expected. But equally, it's legitimate to say that Trump seems very close to Putin or certainly has seemed sympathetic. But there is the question asked, if you're anti this deal or certainly where it looks like it's going to land, what's the alternative? Because at this point, it's really hard to see. The Europeans and the US aren't going to arm Ukraine or sanction things to the point where they could actually fight back in a meaningful way. I don't know what, you know, the Europeans might tweak this deal, but essentially they haven't got like an absolute alternative to it. And Trump's right when he says they're still buying oil from Russia as well, have done throughout this war. A lot of European states still doing that.
I know, they're so hypocritical. I just think they think like bureaucrats and it hasn't gone through their bureaucratic processes and therefore it can't happen. The only way to end the war is to cede certain territories in eastern Ukraine to Russia.
Which is sickening, but like it doesn't, I don't know what the alternative would be at this point.
Is it sickening? Because, you know, does Russia have a claim on some of those territories? You know, I please don't ask me to comment on that. I don't know, but I do know that Russians think they have a claim on them. But in any case, that's the only way the war ends. And then both sides need to be able to declare a victory, which presumably they're going to do. And I guess the EU wants to be able to say we ended the war and Trump wants to be able to say he ended the war. And that kind of seems to me what they're arguing about, but I don't know. If they don't cede certain territory in eastern Ukraine, it's just going to go on and on and on forever.
We're going to see. I mean, this is the thing with Trump's involvement with ending some of these conflicts, right? On the one hand, it's so great that he has this benevolence of spirit and where maybe we've been too hard on him. But I do also feel like there's going to suddenly be Trump Towers in the Middle East, Trump Towers in Saudi, Trump Towers in Crimea. I mean, like
The Black Sea.
Trump Golf Resort.
Yeah.
The naked way that he's sort of gained the power of being president in full view is quite breathtaking, isn't it? When you look at like the cryptocurrency and
I know.
There's just not going to be a reckoning for this, is there? It's just going to happen.
It's just like, he's like one of those old, he's so brazen. And like that cryptocurrency was just like a massive flex. You buy this cryptocurrency, you can come and have dinner with me.
I mean, it does make you think about how cheaply the it happens in this country. There's Keir Starmer wearing his fucking free glasses.
I know.
And there's Donald Trump opening resorts all around the world. And he's got his own cryptocurrency. And then, yeah.
Well, the Black Sea needs is the Starmer golf course.
And then Angela Rayner with some free AirPods. God, this country's fucked. Okay, listen, me and Dom are going to share a couple of circuit war stories, but for everyone else, it will be the end of the show. Okay, that was some bone of Steph stories in there. They're a lot of fun, man. So listen, if you want to join the Patreon and hear those, then they're there for you the moment that you join. Dom, is there anything you want to push here? I see that you've got The Secret History of Gold, your most recent book, behind you.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a very nice Christmas present, nice hardback copy. The book looks really nice if you're interested in gold. It's not a financial book. It's more like just telling the story of this amazing metal. So yeah, if you want to buy that, that would be great. And if you want to... I have two newsletters. I have one for my comedy, which is frisbees.news. So if you want to come and see me do my unacceptable songs, all my dates are up there and at frisbees.news. And if you're interested in my financial stuff, it's theflyingfrisbee.com.
Okay, well, listen, and yeah, of course, check out Dom's socials. Loads of really funny songs and great performances. Always a brilliant act to see live. Thanks very much for joining us this week, Dom.
Thank you, Jeff. Always a pleasure.
Okay, and then there will obviously, post-budget, I'll be doing a breaking news episode later in the week, which might just be me crying. Let's just all cry together, because it's not going to be good news, is it?